Stay tuned for this year's Public Interest Environmental Law Conference on the Florida Youth Petition to make Florida carbon neutral.
Everyone, welcome to the 40th Annual Public Interest Environmental Law Conference. Thank you for coming to the youth-led petition for 100% renewable energy in Florida by 2050 panel. My name is Georgia, and I'm a 1L PILC representative, and I will be moderating this panel today. We will now introduce our panelists. We have Anders Carlson, OCT Energy and Climate Analyst. Anders Carlson has studied climate change and its impacts for over 20 years, and he earned a BA in geology and in German from Augustana College, IL, an MS in geology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a PhD in geology with a minor in oceanography from Oregon State University. As an academic researcher and professor, Anders focused on ice sheet and glacier changes, their attendant impacts on sea levels and climate, abrupt climate change, and the role of greenhouse gases in Earth's orbit in driving regional to global climate change. In addition to the lower 48 and the North Atlantic, his field areas included Alaska, Arctic Canada, Greenland, Svalbard, mainland Scandinavia, Patagonia, and Antarctica. Anders now uses his broad climate expertise to help bring about meaningful change to reduce atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations and create a better tomorrow. This passion permeates over into his free time, where glaciers hold a special place in his heart. He spent as much time as possible with his family exploring and skiing in the Alpine Zone. Next, we have Paul Rink, OCT Senior Fellow, and he is originally from Gaylord, the top knuckle of your middle finger on the hand Michigan map, or as his mother likes to call it, Little Siberia. He earned his JD from Yale Law School and his Master's of Environmental Management from Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies in 2019. After graduating with a BS from the University of Michigan in 2012, Paul taught soil science and environmental science to Singaporean students at Ngee Ann Polytechnic. He then worked on policy advocacy in the International Water Management Institute in Sri Lanka. Most recently, Paul researched the impact of business interests on international environmental law as a Fox Fellow in Mexico City. He has written publications ranging from the household economic benefits of rainwater harvesting systems to a comparative analysis of forestry policies in Indonesia and Brazil. Paul is a huge cinephile who relaxes by running, reading, and writing poetry. Next, we have David Schwartz, who is a native of sunny Southern California, but has lived across the US. He earned his BA in history from the University of Michigan in 2012 and his JD from Duke University School of Law in 2015. David has worked exclusively in the nonprofit environmental and public interest law sphere since graduating law school, with stints at Duke Law's Environmental Law and Policy Clinic, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and Georgetown's Institute for Public Representation. During these positions, he worked on a wide array of environmental, administrative, and freedom of information law matters, including amicus briefs on behalf of coalitions of public health organizations challenging Trump administration Clean Air Act rollbacks. Now as a staff attorney at OCT, David works on a range of litigation and policy work in OCT's state and federal cases. In his free time, David enjoys playing guitar and harmonica, walking and training his rescued pit mix Cooper, hiking, and going on long bike rides. Finally, we have Delaney Reynolds, who is a 22-year-old climate activist, native Floridian, won out at the University of Miami School of Law, and a lead petitioner in OCT-supported and youth-led petition for 100% renewable energy with the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Delaney was also the lead plaintiff in the OCT-supported youth climate lawsuit in Florida, Reynolds v. State. For much of Delaney's life, she has tirelessly advocated for climate change action and renewable energy. Since the age of 14, Delaney has worked through her own nonprofit organization, the Sink or Swim Project, to educate people around the world on climate change and energy issues. She has worked with political leaders by writing ordinances that mandate the installation of solar panels on new buildings in the city of South Miami. She has testified before governmental entities on a range of climate change and energy issues, including presenting a solar energy ordinance she helped develop for the city of South Miami. Delaney has appeared on numerous press outlets, including National Geographic, MTV, and on radio and print media to advocate on climate and energy issues. She has also worked with governmental leaders, including at the UN, as part of her advocacy work. With that, I'll pass it over to the panelists.
As you heard, my name is Delaney Reynolds. I'm the founder and CEO of the Sink or Swim Project, an educational nonprofit dedicated to educating people about climate change and getting involved in political advocacy work. So as such, I've been involved with Our Children's Trust in many different forms since 2016. I was the lead plaintiff in the Reynolds v. State of Florida lawsuit, and I'm now a petitioner in our recent work that we will be talking about today. And as you heard, I'm also joined by David Schwartz, Paul Rink, and Anders Carlson.
Thank you, Delaney. And so as a brief introduction for Our Children's Trust and the work that we do, in case you, any of the attendees here aren't familiar, Our Children's Trust is a nonprofit public interest law firm that provides strategic campaign-based legal services to youth from diverse backgrounds to secure their legal rights to a safe climate. In furtherance of this mission, we advocate for the voices of youth and future generations in climate rights and strategic lawsuits brought against state governments and the federal government here in the United States. We advocate, as a part of this legal advocacy, we advocate only for science-based and legally enforceable systemic remedies in courts. And all of this is geared around protecting fundamental human rights.
So today we'll be talking about a few different things. First, our previous and current work together in the state of Florida. Anders will review some of the underlying science and will address the technical feasibility of the actions that we are aiming to achieve. We'll also talk about the legal framework for our goals, our next steps, and then we'll have some time for questions at the end. So as I mentioned, I was the lead plaintiff in the Reynolds versus the State of Florida climate lawsuit, where we sued the State of Florida, its governor, the Commissioner of Agriculture, and the rest of the cabinet for not upholding duties that were outlined in the Florida Constitution and public trust doctrine that declare that they must protect our public trust resources, our land, our water, our environment, and our atmosphere, our air. So by pumping massive amounts of carbon dioxide from the use of burning fossil fuels into the atmosphere, they haven't been doing that. So seven of my friends and I sued our government here in Florida, asking the court to demand that they make plans and rules that will eliminate and cut back our carbon emissions. Unfortunately, on appeal, the case was dismissed, but now we're onto a new project that we'll talk about in a few minutes. But before we do, I wanted to share that the reason why we took such aggressive action. And that is because here in the state of Florida, we are quite literally watching our environment, our such fragile environment, go extinct. Not only are we watching our state slowly sink underwater, but scientists predict that South Florida alone could see 6 to 10 feet of sea level rise in the decades to come. I've seen the flooding worsen firsthand over my short 22 years on this planet living in South Florida. And because there's so much political inaction here, because we have so much climate denial at the state level here in Florida, we have to act quickly and aggressively in order to get our state leaders to listen to us and protect our futures. My generation, the one below me, the generations to come, they need to protect us over the polluting fossil fuel industry. So that is why we took that action. And that is why we've continued to work with our Children's Trust and work on the petition, which you will hear about today.
Thank you, Delaney. And some additional context for the attendees here. So following Reynolds, there was a bit of a strategic shift in terms of focusing on more administrative agency action in the state of Florida. Aside from the role that the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services plays in the Florida's electricity sector, another key agency in the state of Florida is the Florida Public Service Commission, and they have regulatory oversight over Florida's utilities system, so electric utilities, gas utilities, and things like that. Recently, our Children's Trust, in support of youth commenters, submitted comments on the Public Service Commission's ongoing rulemaking to update its energy efficiency goals. So this is a kind of another area that our Children's Trust is looking into as we expand our work in the state of Florida. But all of this work that we've identified, Reynolds and the administrative work, fundamentally relies on upholding and advocating for the best available science. The best available science indicates that global carbon dioxide concentrations must be reduced to 350 parts per million by 2100 in order to avoid the most severe impacts of climate change and to return the planet to the stable climate conditions that existed during the past 10,000 years in which modern human civilization as we know it was flourishing. This is a very important concept that OCT likes to hammer in everything that we do, because the politically accepted targets of the Paris Agreement of 1.5 or even 2 degrees centigrade are not in accordance with the best available science. They are not levels that equate to safe, you know, warming of the climate system. The impacts that we're already seeing currently at warmings of around 1.1 to 1.2 degrees centigrade, we can see the impacts that are happening, especially here in the Pacific Northwest and across the globe. So one can only imagine the sorts of impacts that would happen at 1.5 to and even greater than 2 degrees centigrade. So our Children's Trust always makes sure to advocate based on this 350 parts per million standard and when we fashion our remedies in court.
What are those impacts and how are they, what are they doing to Florida? So this is a figure here from a study came out 2 years ago. And this is showing the trends in climate extremes from 1981 to 2005. So this is occurring even when we were below 400 parts per million. So this is, we've crossed the 400 ppm level in 2015. And so this is, you know, trends that are occurring even before we've gone to the craziness of the last 5-6 years. And what comes out of this is that Florida is really ground zero for climate impacts in the United States. The upper left-hand corner is showing you extreme warm nights and a trend in those. And Florida's leading the nation, or the black dots show you statistically significant trends. So these are real trends and not just, they're trends above the noise. And Florida's leading the nation in increasing warm nights. And cold nights are decreasing. There's also growing drought there and growing moist conditions. So both extremely dry and extremely wet, and intense wet events are increasing the greatest in Florida as well, down in the bottom left. You combine all those together in a climate extremes index that's showing the bottom right, and you'll see that Florida is the most extreme place in the lower 48. And so it is leading the nation in terms of what climate is doing and causing negative impacts on the people that live there and life and the ecosystems of Florida as well. Now, what is going to come in the future, though, beyond this is only up to 2005, will be increased mortality. Heat waves kill people. Rising sea levels displace people. And there will the rising heat and extreme wet conditions. Well, the rising heat will cause increased energy demand. And you're going to, the most basic one is people are going to run more air conditioners. And so just they're going to require more energy, and where they're getting their energy from now is causing the problems to begin with. You should not be using fossil fuels to fight heat waves, basically. There will be a loss of outdoor labor. So there'll be economic impact. People just can't work as long when it's really wet out or really hot out. And that'll lead towards less income and lower GDP, gross domestic product. And lastly, Florida, in the last 5-10 million years, all of Florida has been under sea level. It is a state made on marine rocks from the last deposited in the last 5-10 million years, when ice sheets were smaller and not even in existence. So sea levels were higher. So Florida exists from warm periods in the past. And as we warm up again, sea level will rise and Florida will be drowned. And so they will be facing coastal loss and loss of land as well. So it's all bad for the future, and it's already bad now. Okay, so what's driving this? Well, global warming is a global problem, but Florida has its role in driving this instance, this occurrence. And so on the left-hand side is a figure from the of the total emissions of carbon dioxide in million metric tons from 1980 to 2020 from the state of Florida in terms of the energy production. So this would be not including emissions from the making of cement or steel. So it's majority of the CO2 emissions, but not all of them. And since the early 80s up to the early 2000s, Florida was emitting more and more carbon dioxide each year at about 4.8 million more metric tons every year. And then in the mid-aughts up till 2009, CO2 emissions dropped and reversed again after 2009. And it's been rising, emissions have been rising at about 1.2 million more metric tons of CO2 per year. On the right-hand side is showing then where this is CO2 is being emitted. And so this is a two-part graph here, and it's been broken down on the left-hand side, showing you absolute emissions from the transportation, electrical sector, industry, and then residential and commercial sectors. And then on the right-hand side is showing that as a percent of total emissions. And you'll see the two big kahunas are electricity and transportation. And we are going to focus on electricity today. So the amount of CO2, trying to reduce the CO2 emissions and greenhouse gas emissions from the electrical sector of Florida, which was its largest emission sector. And then only in the mid, like around 2014-15, did the transportation eclipse it. But they're both close, and it easily could have changed here with the COVID pandemic coming along. So what is coming into the future? So where is Florida generating its electricity? And the left is, these are both figures from the state of Florida, not made by us. And the left is showing you the sources of energy or electricity here, gigawatt loads, the load of energy produced and where it's coming from. And the light green is the real problem for Florida. That's the natural gas contribution to electricity generation. And you can see that increasing over the last decade, Florida has been increasing its natural gas, its electricity source of natural gas, up to where it's almost, in 2020, it was almost 3/4 of its electricity was generated from natural gas. The little orange slices there up through 2020 are solar. And so renewable energy, and that has been increasing slightly. And now the other side here from 2021 to 2030 is showing you the state of Florida's projections of where it will be getting its electricity in the future. And up through 2030, it's roughly about 2/3 of electricity still going to be coming from natural gas, though solar is expanding. Now, if you look at the right-hand side, this is showing you 2021 versus 2030. And while the absolute amount of electricity generated has increased, the fraction coming from natural gas stays the same over this whole decade. So the reliance on gas is a constant. And I said that renewables, particularly solar, is increasing, going from 5% to 15%. That's really at the expense of coal. and a little bit of nuclear and a little other sectors is not impacting their use of actual natural gas. And so Florida, you could say, has an addiction to natural gas. So what do we propose to do? We used here partnering up with a firm that looks at energy pathways, has put forward pathways to get the Earth, get the North, the globe evolved emission pathways that would put the United States and states within the United States on a pathway to zero emissions by 2050, not net zero, but absolute zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, which is the pathway needed to then, by the end of the century, have the globe be below 350 ppm of CO2 in the atmosphere. So the left-hand figure here is a dual graph again, showing you the total emissions for all the state of Florida from its energy sector, not just electricity, on a business as usual. So what their pathway they are going along for reference up through 2050. And then on the right-hand side of that left figure is showing you then the pathway we chosen from the multiple pathways put forward by EER. We petitioned for the 100% renewable pathway. So the one with the least amount of emissions and the least reliance on other energy sources such as nuclear, or using, say, natural gas, but with carbon capture. So you're still actually emitting CO2, but having to capture it. And this is just for the electrical sector. So you want to focus in on the light blue shading there, where on the left, electrical sector is emitting more or less the same amount of CO2 by 2050 that it was in 2020, just a slight less, bit less. Whereas what we propose, it is going down to zero by 2050. And what will this cost? The right-hand side is showing you then this cost of this transition pathway, of these different pathways forward, relative to the historical cost of the energy system in Florida. And that's the black line. So from 1980 through 2017, I think we have the data for 2018, it's showing you the black line is showing the percent of the gross domestic product being spent on electricity. So what percentage of this is being used for generating energy, not electricity. And while it's declined a lot since 1980, the long-term average over the last two decades is about 7% of GDP has been spent on energy. Going forward now, the reference case to business as usual has about 5% of GDP. And the renewable pathway we proposed is a little bit more expensive, but it's still this less than a historical average, and it still costs less than anything Florida has seen over the last 40 years. And so it's actually cheaper to go 100% renewables than to keep it as it has been. And this cost does not include the added benefits of addressing greenhouse gas emissions and the attendant climate change. So there's not included in this is the factors where we don't have people getting sick. We are not losing lives from heat waves. We are not having to rebuild communities over and over again as the sea levels rise. And people are able to drive electric cars, which just don't cost as much money to maintain as gas-powered cars. And so this doesn't include all the added benefits, which would make the 100% renewables case cheaper than the reference case if a full economic budget was done. Why does this need to be done? Well, because Florida has these projections. And so the left-hand side is showing you the historical sources of electricity for Florida with natural gas increasing, the red blob there going up through 2020, ever growing. And then the little blue one is showing you what renewables is of the total electricity generated. And then that from 2021 through 2030 is showing you the projections that Florida has. And you'll see that renewables are increasing in terms of the total generated power. And natural gas is also increasing, and that's mainly at the expense of coal and nuclear and some other small contributing sources of electricity. You project these to the future based on what Florida's plans are. And in 2140, so five generations from now, the electricity being generated by renewable energy sources will be about it will equal that of natural gas. So Florida does have a plan for parity between renewable non-greenhouse gas emission sources and natural gas electricity, but it's five generations out. So Florida can do better, and that's where we come to our proposed new electrical plan.
So as Anders just laid out, it's both technically feasible and economically beneficial for Florida to incorporate a rapid increase in renewable energy into its electricity sector. So the question becomes, why isn't Florida already doing that? Well, the answer is things become much more tricky when you look at the political aspects of Florida. So as many of you may be aware, most of the governmental agencies and the legislature in Florida are run by Republicans who happen to be close friends with the fossil fuel industry. And so just as an example, recently the legislature passed a law that prohibits municipalities from forbidding dirty fossil fuel energy from being used to provide electricity within their city limits, which is actually a little ironic given that a typical platform of the Republican and conservative ideologies is to not have governmental overreach. And this would be a clear example of governmental overreach by the state government. But that's just an aside. But also just today, actually, the House of Representatives in the state of Florida just passed a bill that would restrict net metering capabilities within Florida, which basically means that individuals who have private homes that would like to incorporate solar panels into their private units will have less economic incentive and benefits in doing so. And this could throw a huge wrench into the solar energy industry within Florida. So the politics can be quite complicated, but luckily we actually have a lot of really helpful legal provisions that can work against that political landscape. So although the current legislature is doing everything it can to try to prevent renewable energy promotion within the state, historically the legislature has expressed a clear intent to promote renewable energy within Florida. As you can see from the text that's provided on this slide, the statutes of Florida demonstrate that the legislature is really intending to address the potential of global climate change wherever possible, including by promoting the development of renewable energy and trying to dampen down the dependence of Florida on natural gas and other types of fossil fuels for the production of electricity. Now, that intention is all well and good, but how to actually make that happen within the state of Florida is another question, because the Administrative Procedures Act, which dictates how agencies can produce rules, is very, very strict within Florida. In particular, it includes two requirements that must be met before an agency can promulgate a rule. The first is that a statute must explicitly provide the agency with authority to do the particular action the agency wants to do in its rulemaking procedures. And the second is a different statute must separately provide the authority to adopt rules pursuant to that particular mandate or authority. And so this actually brings us to a particular interesting aspect of the petition for rulemaking, which is that it was filed with the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, which might on its face seem unusual. But because of some historical finagling within the Florida politics, the Office of Energy is actually housed within the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. And so that department is actually in charge of energy policy within the state. And as such, and because of this intention from the legislature to promote renewable energy, we were actually able to find statutes specifically mandating the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services to promote the development and use of renewable energy resources by establishing specific goals for increasing that use. And in addition, the agency has been provided by the legislature with the authority to make rules pursuant to that aim. And so both aspects of the requirements under the Administrative Procedures Act are met for this particular department to create a 100% goal of achieve a goal of achieving 100% renewable energy in the electricity sector in Florida by 2050. With that in mind, this is the first provision of the proposed rule that was put forward by Delaney and her co-petitioners back in January. And this is a lot of text, but I wanted to draw your attention to just a few aspects of what's written on the slide. So first of all, if you look right before the colon in the first part of the sentence, it refers to achieving the following goals. So we actually chose the word goals specifically because it's tied explicitly within the statutory text related to the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services statutory authority. And so you wanted to be very careful to use the language that's actually provided in statute that gives the agency the authority to adopt these goals and strategies, so that any contestation that this is not something that's within the authority of the department is easily gone away with, because it's clear that the legislature has given it the authority to do exactly what we're asking it to do. And on that note, I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that the text also refers to the overall electricity use within the state of Florida, as opposed to overall energy use. Obviously, given our goals for approaching climate action, we would prefer to have a goal that establishes 100% renewable energy within the entire energy sector in Florida. However, because we're working within the statutory language relevant to the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, that particular department only has authority over the electricity sector in Florida. And that's why the goal is aimed specifically at that sector within the overall energy sector. And then finally, I wanted to point your, I wanted to draw your attention to the percentages of renewable energy targeted by the particular dates. So 40% renewable energy by 2030, 63% by 2035, 82% by 2040, and 100% by 2050. So those aren't just arbitrary numbers, although they might seem to be on their face. They are actually determined by our partners at the Evolved Energy Research Consultancy Agency. And so they're explicitly tied to what has been determined to be technologically feasible and economically beneficial for the state of Florida. And there are other experts that we rely on as well that back up those particular targets and those particular dates. To save your eyes, we decided to not include all the other provisions from the proposed rule in these slides, but they are summarized here. And I just wanted to point your attention to a couple of things relevant to these other provisions. So notice that all of the action verbs specified in these bullet points: collecting energy data, preparing forecasts for energy, submitting comments and making recommendations, all of those verbs are explicitly provided for in the statutory authority of the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. For the same reason that we decided to tie the goals language specifically to what the department is authorized to do by the legislature, every other provision, we were very careful to make sure that it could tie back to explicit statutory authority and also authority to adopt rules pursuant to those mandates by the legislature. So another thing I'd like to draw your attention to really quickly is that these verbs, collect, prepare, submit, they're all sort of related to the inner workings of the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. They're imposing requirements on the department itself, as opposed to imposing requirements external to the department on, for example, electric utilities or other entities within the state or even other agencies. And the reason we tried to focus our attention on imposing requirements within the agency is because of another particular aspect of the Administrative Procedures Act within Florida, which mandates that if the overall costs of a new rule are going to impose greater than $200,000 on anything within the state within the first year of enactment, then that rule has to go to the legislature for approval. And as we mentioned, the legislature in Florida is very friendly with the fossil fuel industry. We really don't want to have to present the rule to that legislature because we're afraid that they wouldn't approve it. And so by tying all of these requirements specifically to the agency itself, we are basically avoiding that requirement to estimate regulatory costs in front of the legislature.
Thank you, Paul. So as Paul alluded to, this year on January 5th, 2022, Delaney and a cohort of 156 young Floridians under the 25 or younger filed this petition with Commissioner Nikki Fried at the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. We would have liked to do an in-person, you know, kind of delivery of the petition, but the outstanding COVID situation required that we submit this virtually and in hard copy. You know, this is all to say that there was the filing of the petition itself is really only the beginning of this long process. And even leading up to the petition, there was a great deal of work in order to amass this, that number of passionate young Floridians who are concerned about, you know, their climate rights and climate justice in their state. You know, we had a very comprehensive social media outreach program to try to boost the boost the petition opportunity. You know, really wanting to get the word out to young people in Florida that they could make their voices heard. And this was a crucial activity, given or a crucial opportunity, given the clear statutory authority and the technical feasibility and economic viability of the underlying plan. So once the petition was filed on the 5th of this year, that triggered a 30-day timeframe under Florida's APA, under which FDACS had to respond to the petition. So under Florida law, if an agency receives a petition for rulemaking, they have 30 days, calendar days, not just work days, in which to either grant the petition by starting the rulemaking process or deny the petition by, you know, submitting a written statement to the petitioner saying, this is why we're not going to go forward with your rule. So as I had mentioned with our outreach program leading up to the filing of the petition, we had a similar kind of outreach program that took place in between the filing of the petition on the 5th and when we heard some movement from the department on the 4th. You know, that included emails, letters to from youth or concerned organizations to kind of put pressure on Commissioner Freed to grant the petition and promulgate the petitioner's rule as proposed. I guess another, just by way of context, you know, another reason why we focus so heavily on the Department of Agriculture, not only because of the statutory authority and the legislative intent was so clear, is also because of the overarching political situation in the state. Commissioner Freed is the only Democrat in Florida's cabinet currently, and she has larger political aspirations. She's not going to be the agriculture commissioner going forward. She has announced her candidacy for Florida governor, and she is going to be involved in a primary contest against former Democratic Governor Charlie Crist. Also, you know, Commissioner Freed in her career in politics in Florida has been very vocal about the climate crisis and about climate change in general, you know, going so far as to call it, you know, an existential crisis, an emergency. You know, we must act better. And we really wanted to use this opportunity in the run up to the Democratic primary and the run up to the election in general to put something, you know, well-researched, you know, rock solid on her desk to force her to either, you know, act in accordance with her rhetoric or have the politically and PR unfavorable position of saying one thing but acting to deny a request by impacted youth in the state of Florida. So as the slide says, the department acted within that 30-day timeframe following our filing of the petition. They issued a notice of development of rulemaking on February 4th. While that might seem like a big step forward in the rulemaking process, the notice of development was not substantive in any manner. Under Florida's APA and rulemaking process, the agencies can just announce like, hey, we're intending to move forward with a rulemaking of some form in this topic area. And that's essentially what they did. This notice does not have any proposed text, didn't have any details or economic analyses if they were required, things like that. So we were very, very heartened to see, the Department of Agriculture serious about moving forward with this. And, you know, we're looking forward to ensuring that the strongest will possible is put forward. So, like I said, that notice that the department issued on the 4th, you know, was kind of the beginning of an open-ended process. Florida's APA does not spell out any specific timeframe for the rule development process. What we're wanting to do is take this kind of out of the rule development process, under which there's an open-ended timeframe. There's nothing really by which the agency has to act by, and move this into the rule adoption phase. And so how that begins is the agency publishes a new notice, which is the notice of proposed rulemaking. And unlike the notice of development, this notice of proposed rulemaking is what you would typically consider to be like the beginning of the rulemaking process. It has the text of the proposed rule, has the agency's statement, analysis as to why it's doing what it's doing, and other required elements for that process under Florida's APA. Once that is issued, that triggers the rule adoption process phase is very important because that has concrete timelines by which the agency must act under law. In general, once that agency issues that notice of adoption, they have 90 days to adopt the rule. That 90-day time period can be extended under a number of different circumstances, but more or less that's the one to focus on. Another important aspect of this rule adoption phase is that it typically involves public hearings. And importantly, once the agency issues that notice, any interested person in the state of Florida can request a public hearing to the agency within 21 days. And importantly, the agency, if it receives a request for a public hearing, it has to hold at least one. And so, you know, this is a something that we're looking forward to seeing the agency move to. We're you know, really hoping that the agency acts quickly to move out of the current rule development phase and move into the rule adoption phase, when we can have these clear timeframes, we can have these public hearings, and these public hearings will allow, obviously, another round of outreach and communications to our supporters and youth in the state. These hearings can involve, obviously, oral testimony if they're held in person, virtual testimony if it's held on Zoom. You can submit additional written authorities to the agency, providing your comments that way. And so we will certainly be engaging with youth and partners in the state of Florida once we know, have a better sense of exactly the timeline going forward. And so, you know, looking ahead, as Paul had mentioned, you know, this is all taking place in the broader context of a very politically conservative state, and a state in which, you know, many of the conservative lawmakers have ties or support from the fossil fuel industry. You know, Paul mentioned the net metering debate that's substantially going to harm the solar industry. We raise all this because, you know, although there are regressive pieces of legislation like the local control, the preemption bills relating to the types of energy use municipalities can allow or disallow, and the net metering debate, it's important to keep tabs on the overall legislative climate, because it's possible that some of the pieces of legislation coming out, even if they on their face are negative, could potentially be of use in future administrative or legal avenues going forward. So for example, in the COVID litigation in Florida relating to mask mandates and things like that, there have been a lot of opinions focusing on, you know, personal freedom and bodily integrity and things of that nature. And in fact, Florida has a fundamental constitutional right to privacy in the home. And so we've been exploring, you know, the district court opinions in Florida relating to personal freedom and the right to privacy in Florida's constitution as potential avenues in litigation concerning climate impacts, right? You know, storm surge and sea level rise impact your ability to live in your home, or if algae blooms in lakes and rivers in Florida are such that they require you to wear a mask in order to not breathe in the toxic gas that the algae is producing, that could rightfully be claimed to be a violation of, you know, bodily integrity, personal freedom, and things of that nature. So it's important to keep in mind the broader political context in which our rulemaking is taking. And finally, you know, like we said, the filing of the petition, and, you know, work, you know, hoping that the agency puts forth the strongest rule possible, and then defending or, you know, working with that rule once it's out. There's a lot more to be done in the state of Florida. And so we're looking forward to working with Delaney, the rest of her, you know, peers and advocates. And it's just a great group of people to work with, lots of passion down there.
Thanks, David. I agree. So despite Florida's political challenges, like David said, we're extremely enthusiastic to work with Commissioner Freed and the Department of Agriculture on our proposed rule and making it a reality, because it's really the first real action that the state of Florida has taken to address climate change. So if you want to show your support, you can learn more about our petition or any of the other work that our Children's Trust is doing by visiting ourchildrenstrust.org, or you can follow them on social media at youthvgov. So thank you again for joining us. And now we're going to field some questions from the Q&A function. So if you have any, be sure to type them into that. It's on the bottom of the Zoom screen. We have one so far. So I'm going to turn this over to either David or Paul. So curious if we are collaborating with activists or lawyers in other states to either support and build political pressure for the petition or to help begin similar petitions in other states.
Sure, I can take the first aspect of this question, and Paul, you can chime in in case I miss anything. So far, our outreach work with the petition in Florida has not tried to rope in any nearby states, right, or organizations in nearby states to voice their support. We've really tried to keep this at least outreach effort central to the state of Florida. But that being said, you know, our Children's Trust in the past has engaged in rulemaking petitions before. I believe there was a rulemaking petition in the state of Alaska, in the state of Oregon. We had one in the works in the state of North Carolina. This approach and the process of submitting rulemaking petitions to state agencies is nothing new. It's certainly an avenue of work that our Children's Trust has used before and is increasingly looking to use as potential avenues to advance climate rights and climate justice.
Thanks, David. And I would just add that obviously the research entailed to come up with this petition for rulemaking was very Florida-centric. And so it's not necessarily easily applicable to other states, but the overall strategy can be done in other states in the context of the laws of that state. And if someone from another state is seeing this and is becoming interested in trying to do something similar in their state, that's something that we would love to collaborate on or try to work with you on, because it's definitely petitions for rulemaking happen in agencies across the country. And depending on what is happening in your state, it might be easier even to do it in your state, given the current political atmosphere within Florida. And just as another aside, our Children's Trust does work in lots of other states outside of just rulemaking. So there's ongoing litigation that's taking place in states ranging from Virginia to Montana. And in fact, the first youth-led climate case that's going to trial in the United States is happening in Montana right now, Held versus Montana, and its trial dates are set for March of 2023. So definitely, if you're interested in any of that, please follow the information that Delaney gave you about our Children's Trust, and you can definitely learn more about those activities.
Thank you. And then we have another one. So the rulemaking process can take a long time. Don't know the specific time limits for Florida's version of the APA. Is there a concern that Florida will attempt to drag its feet to make the research moot? If so, do we have a plan around that?
Sure. I can start off again, Paul, if that's okay. So yes, there are a number of opportunities in which the rulemaking process can be delayed, extended, or even quashed, both by their government and by outside interests. For example, I don't recall all of the specifics off the top of my head, but for example, Florida's APA allows for what are called substantially interested persons. This can be a corporation with financial interests, or someone like Delaney who has interests in protecting, her home and community and environment that she loves so dearly, right? So substantially interested persons, if they feel as though the rulemaking process is not going to adequately protect their interests, they could request that the agency hold some sort of administrative hearings to determine the proper process to protect their interests. Then that becomes something else. The rulemaking is put on hold while those hearings are ongoing. In addition, like Paul had mentioned with the economic cost analysis, there are ways that outside parties could potentially challenge the agency's cost estimates or submit their own. That could potentially tie things up. And the extent also, if the agencies hold public hearings on the rule, which we want them to do, that 90-day general timeframe that I had indicated is extended for a period of 45 days, I believe, after the end of the last public hearing. So yes, there's a number of things depending on what exactly happens if a fossil fuel related interest seeks to challenge the rule in some sort of administrative process. So there are a number of processes that are available that could delay the rulemaking process, but you know, we're prepared for them. Let's just say we're engaging in research, you know, refining our arguments to defend against this. And, you know, this is all to say, like, we try to structure the rule from the beginning so as to minimize these possibilities. These sorts of off ramps from the rulemaking process can't be completely eliminated just by virtue of they exist in Florida law, but we're trying to mitigate them against them as best as possible.
Well, right at the end there, David, you stole what I was going to say, in the sense that the petition itself was really framed to minimize the opportunities for putting up roadblocks for its ultimate promulgation. And so although they are a possibility, we have a lot of confidence that the way it's structured and the way it's written, it has limited the potential for those to come up in the first place or be successful if they do arise. And one last thing I would add is Commissioner Nikki Fried, who's the commissioner of the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, as well as her staff, actually met with us and the petitioners themselves and us representing them in a Zoom meeting. And during those interactions, they actually expressed strong interest in moving the process forward. And so we're very hopeful that even though there's no deadline currently in the development of rulemaking process, that the commissioner and the rest of her staff are going to actually move forward into the rule development phase within the near future. So stay tuned. We'll definitely keep you updated as to that.
So we have another question from Keith. So he says, how much support and interest is there from Florida youth? So I guess I can take that one. So like David said, when we first filed the petition in January, we had 156 Florida youth, 25 and younger, sign onto the petition. And since then, youth have continued to sign onto it. We have hundreds of signatures at this point, well over 200. And so there's a lot of support, even on social media. I had a lot of friends post videos telling other kids to support the petition, sign the petition, share the petition. So it's been widely shared throughout Florida. I've also had a lot of other local organizations talk about it to their board members and to their different youth programs. So it's definitely getting some traction, especially the fact that Commissioner Fried agreed to start the rulemaking process. Once that was determined, that was in the media a lot, and a lot of people were touting that as a great first step for Florida. So we're very happy with how much traction and support the petition has gotten from youth all over the state. It's been really cool to see. Okay, and then another question from Lance. What plans are there to publicize and get the public opinion of Florida behind this rulemaking? David or Paul, do you want to talk about the public hearings, perhaps?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, there are several outreach phases that have occurred throughout the petition process, and I think we're really waiting for this notice of proposed rulemaking before we begin a new kind of outreach campaign. Since the notice of development was something we had a little bit of communications about, you know, announcing that the department was moving forward with the rulemaking process. But, you know, like I said during the presentation, the notice of development was very vague, you know, just said we're going to be doing some sort of rulemaking in this general area in some undetermined period of time. So in terms of messaging and the contents of the specific ask we ask our supporters, or, you know, how we craft our approach, is really going to depend on the substance of what is in that notice, right? If the department issues a very strong rule that incorporates our goals as written, and, you know, we're in support of it, our outreach and messaging will be one way. But if the department, you know, doesn't produce something as strong or as what we propose, we feel that they've kind of backtracked and kind of done something not as up to what we were suggesting, you know, our messaging will shift accordingly. So a lot of our outreach is planned, but exactly how it is framed is yet to be determined.
The only thing I would add is, as David mentioned earlier, once the petition moves into the rule adoption phase, it's possible for anyone to ask for a public hearing. And our Children's Trust is already planning to ask for that public hearing. And there will be a huge media campaign at that time to try to get the word out and try to get up participation from people around the state of Florida, not just young people, but experts and people who are living in Florida who are concerned about renewable energy and everything. So as soon as that happens, we'll be sending out information. And the best way for you to make sure that you know when that happens and when our Children's Trust is trying to get people engaged in that public hearing process is to go to ourchildrenstrust.org and sign up for our newsletter so that you'll make sure that you get that information as soon as it arises.